It's Friday, the 4th of December. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Coming your way, we examine some new developments in this week's mass shooting in California.
I was waiting for news like this to trickle out as the case developed further.
You'll hear from one of the leaders of Southern California's Muslim community on reaction to the shootings in San Bernardino. And we talk with Jeff London in New York City about a new off-Broadway musical. It's all coming your way. We start on International Edition today with a report from CNN. It says one of the two people accused of killing 14 at a holiday party in California posted an online statement pledging allegiance to a leader of the Islamic State militant group. Again, the report from CNN citing U.S. officials on this. Tashfeen Malik and her husband, Saeed Rizwan Farooq, were killed in a shootout with police hours after the Wednesday massacre at the Inland Regional Center. Social Services Agency in San Bernardino, about 60 miles, 100 kilometers east of Los Angeles. The attack was the deadliest mass shooting in the United States in the past 3 years. Malik, a Pakistani native who had been living in Saudi Arabia when she married Farooq, posted an online statement of support for a leader of Islamic State on an account using a name other than her own, according to the CNN report. The attack in San Bernardino appeared to be inspired by, but not directed by, the militant group. Well, joining us to talk about that and more on International Edition is Colin Clark, an associate political scientist at the RAND Corporation. His research is focusing on insurgency and counterinsurgency. Colin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Does this latest news surprise you at all?
No, not in the least. In fact, I was waiting for news like this to trickle out as the case developed further. We've seen similar incidents like this in the past. My sense from the very beginning, once I knew that there was multiple shooters, was that this was terrorism, although it's always better to be cautious until we hear more details. But the fact that this was inspired by ISIS, not necessarily directed, but inspired, is not surprising in the least.
You know, I just checked with the site intelligence group in Bethesda, Maryland, near Washington. They monitor jihadist websites, and they say there has been no claim of responsibility for these shootings by ISIS or any other such group. Any idea why that might be?
Again, it's important to distinguish between something that's centrally coordinated by ISIS, something that's dictated by the group's command and control, like we saw in Paris, and then something like what San Bernardino appears to be, which is a couple that was inspired by the group, right? So this shows the power of ISIS's propaganda. They don't have to actually get in contact with the people necessarily. It's the propaganda, it's the online activity that can inspire these individuals to take action on their own.
So what do you think happened here? I know it's all speculation, but what's your feeling about it?
So this was an individual or a couple that had been, slowly undergoing the radicalization process, probably visiting a lot of extremist sites online, made a couple of visits overseas to both Pakistan and to Saudi Arabia, and clearly just became further and further entrenched. And every radicalization process is different. That's what makes it so difficult to identify. There's no one single prototype that individuals follow. And so there were probably signs that could have been picked up along the way by folks that knew these two people. But again, because there's no single prototype down this path, it's very difficult to spot.
Knowing and examining and researching the type of person who might do something like this, how is it that a young couple living what seems to be a normal U.S. life in a Los Angeles suburb that just had a child 6 months ago could be inspired by something like this?
Yeah, I mean, to regular everyday people, it seems crazy, but it just shows the power and the appeal of this ideology, this Salafist jihadist ideology that's propagated by ISIS, by Al-Qaeda, by other groups online, And really, you know, until we get the digital forensics, I think we're not going to really know much. I saw reports indicating that cell phones were destroyed and that Farouk took out the hard drive. So he's clearly trying to cover his tracks and trying to make it difficult for investigators to piece together the puzzle of exactly how this all came to fruition.
Have we seen other similar attacks, probably not as not as fatal as this one has been, but have been there other similar attacks in your research in this country, in the United States?
I mean, this is happening all the time. FBI Director Comey made a statement a couple of months ago that the FBI's got active investigations in all 50 states. There was a report released recently by Lorenzo Vadino and his colleagues at George Washington University that showed, you know, there's been dozens of arrests this year alone of ISIS supporters in this country. And so we'd be naive to think that this isn't going on at all times. And clearly, this is all taking place on the Internet. This is taking place in cyberspace. But we haven't quite figured out what causes that. What's the catalyst that galvanizes people to make the leap from online activity and support to taking action in the real world?
Does the publicity surrounding this latest incident in California spur other people on, in your opinion?
Yeah, that's a big debate. It's the 24-hour news cycle, right? Everything that happens, the media jumps on and picks apart and highlights. I think it would be irresponsible not to cover this kind of stuff. But perhaps maybe we need to rethink the amount of attention and maybe be a bit more judicious in how these events are covered. In my opinion, it's a shame that too often we're focusing on the attackers themselves and not enough on the victims.
What do you see as being next? What follows this?
Yeah, so following this incident, I'd be looking for other incidents, not only in the United States, but perhaps overseas. The British government just recently declared that they were going to become more aggressive in conducting airstrikes on ISIS, and I think there's been some threats made against the United Kingdom. So I wouldn't be surprised to see this kind of interplay between things happening domestically in the United States and potentially more incidents overseas.
Colin Clark is an associate political scientist at the RAND Corporation. His research is focusing on insurgency and counterinsurgency. Colin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now joining us on International Edition is Amjad Mahmoud Khan. He is the Director of Public Affairs for the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community in Los Angeles, also an adjunct professor of law at the UCLA Law School in Los Angeles. Amjad, thanks so much for being with us. My question deals with the reaction and just the feelings of the Muslim community, if indeed you can codify that or even define that following these shootings in the suburban outside of Los Angeles.
Well, it's certainly been an emotional roller coaster. You know, I grew up in San Bernardino County. The mosque that I congregate has been a beacon of peace for over 30 years, the largest mosque in San Bernardino County. We have many of our congregants who live and work very close to where this horrific massacre occurred. When we first heard the news, it was just absolutely shocking, like all Americans, to see yet another mass shooting, this one the second largest after Sandy Hook, and this cycle of violence that we're seeing increasingly across the country. But when news emerged that the perpetrators were 28 and 27 in that range of age, millennials, Muslims of Pakistani origin, and they had such military-style ammunition, immediately as an American Muslim, my heart sank because I knew that yet again we would be in a position to have to disassociate ourselves from these nefarious acts and get into what I call the condemnation machine and repeatedly condemn these acts. I mean, at the same time, of course, dealing with a very real problem in my mind, which is the radicalization of some American Muslim youth.
What do you think of the radicalization of many young Islamic?
I think it's a real problem, and it's not a large-scale problem at all. I think it's some disaffected Muslim youth who are millennials, who are recruited from foreign forces. In this case, it appears to be that the wife was recruited, or you know, she had sympathies or pledged allegiance to ISIS. We've seen reports earlier this week of ISIS recruiting Americans, even female Americans, for their cause. I think with Faisal Shahzad, when he attempted to blow up Times Square years ago, he's a U.S. citizen. This notion of divided loyalties that exist among some American Muslim youth, that they're loyal, that they're U.S. citizens, but they pledge loyalty abroad to terrorist groups or other countries, and they don't have any you know, deep roots here in the United States, but in fact would cause crimes against humanity, is something that we have to deal with. Our community is extremely transparent. We have a track record of, you know, over a century of battling violent extremism. It's in our DNA to tackle this kind of thing. The individuals had no affiliation whatsoever with our congregation. But at the same time, we need to root out any causes of disaffection among any American Muslim youth. I mean, what triggers this to happen? It could be mental health issues. It could be troubled youth. It could be people who are being recruited, who are being emboldened by fiery rhetoric. These are things that need to be meticulously rooted out, identified, and dealt with by an organized community, and particularly at the youth level.
You obviously know, and we here at VOA hear about it often from our listeners and from our readers of our website, that many people in the worldwide Muslim community, along with thousands and if not millions of others, think that the United States has a very effective and a very strong anti-Muslim contingent. Is that indeed the case? And if you can, just give an overall view of how the Muslim community in the United States views the rest of the U.S. population.
I don't share the view that there is a large-scale anti-Muslim problem in America. I actually am of the view that it is more free to, we are more free to practice our faith as Muslims in America than any other country. I sometimes tell my students and other colleagues that I believe that the U.S. Constitution is in some ways more Islamic at its core than the constitutions of some Muslim governments. I think I share the view of President Obama that the millions of Muslims who are living here are living probably in the best climate to be an American Muslim. That said, there are elements that are anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim. And, you know, 56% of Americans hold a disfavorable view of Islam, yet the same people, most of them, have never even met a Muslim. So I think there's an education deficit that needs to be cured. I think that there are elements of Islamophobia that are real. I spend some of my pro bono practice representing American Muslims on civil liberties violations and keenly aware of hate crimes against American Muslims. But I feel like while Islamophobia is real and we need to tackle that issue, and we should show our concern about that, I don't think American Muslims should use that as a crutch. I think that these are heightened times, and I think we need to be a lot more proactive. And instead of the outrage, we should have a plan of action. And yes, that might mean unfairly that we have to keep apologizing and keep unnecessarily perhaps condemning things that we don't affiliate with, but at the same time, we need to realize that there are individuals, from Faisal Shahzad to the Tsarnaev brothers in Boston to the individuals the other day who have roots and ties in this country, or even American citizens who believe that their faith allows them to commit mass atrocities. And this is just completely unacceptable in the body politic of American Muslims and Islam generally.
Amjad Mahmoud Khan is the National Director for Public Affairs for the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community in Los Angeles and Adjunct Professor of Law at the UCLA Law School. Thanks so much for being with us, Amjad.
My pleasure.
We move on now to social media. Joining us in studio is International Edition's Charlie Hansler. And Charlie, how much is there going on online and in social media dealing with this shooting story from California?
Well, there is a lot being talked about it. The two most common hashtags people are using on this story on Twitter are hashtag San Bernardino and hashtag San Bernardino shooting, with hashtag San Bernardino being the slightly more popular one being used. One really interesting tweet came from Aaron Task, the digital editor of Fortune magazine. From his Twitter handle, at Aaron Task, he tweeted, quote, "And now there's something called active shooter insurance for companies." And this tweet has a link to a story in Fortune magazine about one insurance company called Beasley Group, which is offering insurance to companies to cover the costs of mass shootings.
It's amazing we've come to that, isn't it?
Yeah.
And anything else or anything else trending?
Yeah, National Cookie Day. So #NationalCookieDay is trending on Twitter because there's a lot of more cookie-related discussions on social media than usual.
Chocolate chip, sugar, peanut butter, what's
your
choice?
Yeah, all kinds.
What's your choice?
I actually like oatmeal raisin.
Okay, so everybody know that. Then tell Charlie, what's your tag?
At Charlie Hansler is my Twitter handle.
Charlie Hansler, H-A-N-S-L-E-R. Charlie, thanks for being with us. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Astronomers say an exoplanet found orbiting its star at an incredibly great distance may have been booted from its original closer location to the star in a way similar to what some think took place in our own solar system's early history. The astronomers noticed a possible ring of debris around the planet and an oddly shaped comet belt in its solar system. The scientists said both of these anomalies suggest a violent gravitational disturbance may have been behind the exoplanet's exile to a location some 16 times the distance between Pluto and our Sun. A study released by Canadian researchers in November suggests that we may have had an additional planetary gas giant in our solar system around 4 billion years ago until Jupiter pushed it out. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. About 10 years ago, Griffin Matthews was singing in a church choir when his pastor discovered he was gay and kicked him out. Well, feeling depressed, he booked a ticket to Uganda for mission work. What happened to him next is the subject of a new off-Broadway musical. It's called Invisible Thread. Jeff London's here to tell us more about it.
At the start of Invisible Thread, a young actor walks out on a stage that's covered in red dirt and addresses the audience directly.
My name is Griffin, and this is my story.
Come to this place.
And I actually am Griffin, and it is my story.
New York actor Griffin Matthews, along with his writing and life partner Matt Gould, co-authored the show.
My story starts the way that most stories about black people start. In a church.
I was lost in a valley, alone and afraid of the darkness around me.
He was quickly disillusioned when he learned the man leading his volunteer organization in Uganda was corrupt.
And so I had to figure out what I was going to do for the rest of my 6 weeks in Uganda. And so I walked down the road, tried to clear my head, and I met a group of teenagers who stopped me and said, "Mzungu," which means white person. So I'd gone all the way across the world as a black man, and to them I was a white person.
Wait, who's the white person?
You! Mzungu!
I am black.
How are you? Yay!
Do you guys seriously think that I'm white?
Yay!
The teenagers were all orphans, many because of the country's AIDS epidemic. None of them had the money to pay for school.
I agreed to teach them at a library in the village, and so we started meeting for daily classes.
Back home, Matthews continued his relationship with most of these young people and started to raise money to send them to school. It was songwriter Matt Gould who heard music in his boyfriend's stories.
And I said, "Hey, why don't we write a musical about your experience in Uganda and use it as a way to fundraise?"
And I thought that was the worst idea I'd ever
heard.
It
was the worst idea
ever. That's a horrible idea. Nobody wants to hear a musical about Uganda.
But I thought they did.
Gould wrote 5 songs, which the couple used for a fundraiser. Those 5 songs turned into a full-length musical, which director Diane Paulus urged them to make more autobiographical.
the couple, which is at the heart of this complicated piece, you know, an interracial gay male couple that is trying to figure out how to live in the world, how to marry, so to speak, their desire to make change and make an impact in the world with all the mistakes that they make, with all the challenges that are thrown their way. And that's what the musical really looks at.
The invisible thread of the title stretches between the two gay American men to the Ugandan teenagers, and it's been woven into a very visible cloth. Griffin Matthews says when you add up all the money various versions of the show have raised over the years, it comes to about $200,000. And those teenagers they initially sponsored? Most have graduated from college, some have become nurses, one is a surgeon, another works as an accountant, and one has even become an actor. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Thank you so much for being with us. This is International Edition from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman. Make sure you visit our website at voanews.com. Keep up to date with what is going on in this changing world. Have a good weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Barack Obama has called on the leaders of Turkey and Russia to de-escalate tensions following the downing of a Russian warplane by Turkey last month and to focus on the common threat posed by ISIL and the need to make progress on a political resolution in Syria. The president met with both leaders on the sidelines of the climate change summit in Paris. He expressed regret to Russian President Vladimir Putin over the loss of Russian life, while emphasizing the need to avoid steps that will hinder a political resolution to the Syrian conflict, a key step to defeating ISIL. In remarks after meeting with Turkish President Recep Erdogan, President Obama reiterated his commitment to the security of Turkey and praised Turkey for its generous support for the refugees fleeing the violence in Syria. President Obama expressed hope that in the coming months, Russia will see that using its military to prop up the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad will not succeed in ending the Syrian conflict. Apart from the moral question of the legitimacy of a leader who has killed hundreds of thousands of his own people, President Obama said, as a practical matter, it is impossible for Mr. Assad to bring that country together. I don't expect that you're going to see a 180-degree turn on the Russian strategy over the next several weeks, said President Obama. They have invested for years now in keeping Assad in power. That's going to take some time for them to change how they think about the issue. But President Obama said it is possible over the next several months that we see a shift in calculation in the Russians and a recognition that it's time to bring the civil war in Syria to a close. What can happen, said President Obama, is if the political process in Vienna aimed at ending the war continues to make progress, then we could see at least pockets of ceasefires in and around Syria. That may mean that certain opposition groups no longer find themselves subject to either Syrian or Russian bombing. They are then in a conversation about politics. And slowly, President Obama said, we then are able to get everybody's attention diverted to where it needs to be. And that is going after ISIL in a systematic way.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.